Critics of Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Diane Douglas today officially launched a recall campaign. So now the signature gathering begins.
This is an uphill effort to do this kind of thing. We've really only had one successful recall in the state, at least at the state level.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, the valley cleans up after last night's storms. A closer look at the remote parts of the Grand Canyon that have high levels of mercury and selenium. How fetal cells can affect the mother years after the baby's born. And starting a specialized law program in mining law.
It makes a lot of sense for schools to study and provide opportunities for, you know, students, lawyers, non-lawyers, that tie into the growth of these local economies.
Plus, making roads safer for cyclists and hiking more user-friendly. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Checking Valley traffic. 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at 32nd Street has the center lane blocked. 51 southbound, the Bell Road exit ramp is restricted. I-10 westbound, the 7th Avenue exit ramp is restricted. And so lots of reports of signals not working in different parts of the valley. Be sure to treat those as four-way stops. Be careful in those areas. Partly sunny skies for the rest of this afternoon. Look for a high of 104, 85 for a low tonight under partly cloudy skies and chance of storms for both times. Right now in Phoenix, relative humidity 32%. It's 97 degrees at KJZZ. Last night's storms came quickly and unexpectedly and were extremely powerful. City residents were notified by the National Weather Service around 7 that a severe storm cell was making its way towards Phoenix, and by 9, power was out across much of central Phoenix, which was hit the hardest. Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton acknowledged the impact this morning at a press conference.
Last night, Mother Nature did a number on our city, and we had thousands of city personnel working throughout the night.
The storm caused flooding, winds, downed trees and power poles, and made a mess of many of the valley's roadways. Stanton says cleanup efforts are still underway.
Obviously, there was significant street flooding in the city of Phoenix, much debris in the roadway. Unfortunately, much of it cleaned up, but some of it is still there. Dozens and dozens of traffic signals lost power. And of course, during the major rush hour commute time this morning, some of our major thoroughfares, our police officers were out there directing traffic and making sure people could get to work as safely as possible.
Workers were cutting tree limbs at the state capitol building as part of that cleanup. Phoenix Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management Kevin Kalkbrenner says emergency services were deluged with calls during last night's storm.
Police reported 509 incidents last night, but no gap in their service. Fire had 582 total calls, with 318 in Phoenix. On average, we get approximately 300 in Phoenix within that 24-hour period, and we saw this from 7 to 11.
The Phoenix Zoo was closed today to clean up, although spokeswoman Linda Hardwick says the animals made it through okay.
All of the animals are safe and accounted for. Everybody was great. They weathered the storm very well. A large majority of them were safe, tucked away in their night house, hunkered down.
Hardwick also says several trees are down. There's lots of debris among the pathways, so staff is in the process of cleaning that up. Forecasters are calling for more stormy weather, but Mayor Stanton is calling for preparedness.
There are storms of a similar nature forecasted for the next few nights. We don't know what Mother Nature is going to bring our way, but we do know that we are going to be prepared.
The latest forecast from the National Weather Service in Phoenix calls for a 10% chance of showers and storms today and tonight. This morning, the Coalition to Recall Diane Douglas began its efforts to recall the Superintendent of Public Instruction. Organizer Max Goschert spoke at the Secretary of State's office after filing the application.
We asked her during her, we are listening to her, listen, we would rather not recall you. We would rather you come out with a plan to improve public education in Arizona. She has done no such thing. That's why we believe, and that's why the people of Arizona believe, that she must be recalled.
For more on this story, I'm joined by Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, what has to happen for there to actually be a recall election?
By law, they have to get 25% of the signatures of the people who voted in that election last time around. That comes out about 366,000. But given the history of the state and how many signatures get disqualified, you probably need 455,000. more the point that by starting the petition drive this morning, they now have the clock running, and they have 120 days or till December 30th to do that. And then they go through the verification process, and depending on what happens, perhaps a year from now, we might actually have an election.
I would imagine that organizers are fairly confident they can get that number of signatures.
Well, they claim that they can do it with volunteers, but you have to remember, this is an uphill effort to do this kind of thing. We've really only had one successful recall in the state, at least at the state level, and that, of course, was former state Senate Chief Russell Pierce. But there were organizers in that had been working on that effort essentially for years. This is a lot of signatures to get and make sure that they're accurate. And then, even assuming they get the signatures, then you set up an election. Other people have to decide, do they want to run? And folks have to decide, is Diane Douglas doing what we elected her to do in the first place last year?
Organizers had been talking about doing this for a while. State law obviously precludes an effort until an official has been in office for 6 months, in this case, a Superintendent Diane Douglas. This has not been an administration free of controversy and free of headlines, and it basically started pretty soon after she took office, didn't it?
Well, it started very soon after she took office. But you have to remember, she was elected on a platform of getting rid of the Common Core academic standards. And she came in and figured, well, I'm now elected, I'm going to do that. Well, there's a small problem with that, including that you have the State Board of Education, which is a constitutionally separate body. They set the policy. They have the employees. And that's what led to the first confrontation where she tried to fire two State Board of Ed employees who she said were, quote, liberal staff who have publicly stated they will block all efforts to repeal or change Common Core. Well, then the governor interceded and said, you're not fired. We went down the rabbit hole on that. Things calmed down for a while, but it's been a constant fight with the State Board of Education, leading to lawsuits, leading even to this bizarre little incident about a week ago where she accused the president of the state board of assaulting her by trying to slap away her microphone during a board meeting. This has been, for lack of a better word, a comedy of errors.
Have you heard from Superintendent Douglas about this effort? I mean, has she talked about how she intends to defend herself?
Well, her position has been, I'm not paying any attention to any recall. I'm doing the people's job. Come talk to me when they get the signatures and we'll go from there. And so she says she's not focused on it.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
Despite its remoteness, the Colorado River at the bottom of the Grand Canyon is dealing with pollution. A new study from the U.S. Geological Survey finds high levels of mercury and selenium in wildlife living there. David Walters is an ecologist with USGS and lead author of the study. David, when did you start looking into this?
We started looking into this in 2008. My colleagues and some of other scientists from outside of USGS were doing a very detailed food web study in the Colorado River and Grand Canyon. There were high concentrations, relatively high concentrations of mercury and selenium in other parts of the Colorado Basin, but there were no data on mercury and selenium from the Grand Canyon itself. And so we recognized this as sort of a big hole or a data gap that we could fill and then combine the mercury and selenium data with their more detailed food web characterization.
And you found that there were high levels of mercury and selenium in this part of the Grand Canyon. How high were they?
What we found was that the concentrations of mercury and selenium were typically higher than what has been found in other river systems, even large rivers that drain more impacted landscapes, for example, the Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri rivers. And then we found that oftentimes concentrations that we measured in organic matter or insects and fish were above these thresholds where you might expect some adverse effect if something ate those organisms.
Do we know how these metals got into the river?
Let me back up for a minute. So what we did not do was a source tracking study where we definitively measured those things. But what we have is literature that suggests very strongly two different pathways. The first pathway for selenium is that in the upper Colorado Basin, so the Green Rivers, the Yampa, the San Juan, the Gunnison, et cetera, they drain ancient marine soils, which are naturally rich in selenium. And when you irrigate selenium-rich soils, you wind up with a lot of selenium salts running off back into these rivers. And so what we do know is that there's a tremendous amount of selenium that enters Lake Powell on an annual basis, transported from very, very far upstream, and then a large portion of that selenium exits Lake Powell through Glen Canyon Dam into the river. For mercury, there is a global pool of mercury in the atmosphere, and we know that high concentrations of mercury in remote locations like the Grand Canyon are typically associated with atmospheric deposition. And so what we did not measure in this study was what part of the mercury that we're finding in food webs is coming from this global pool versus what is coming perhaps from more local or regional atmospheric pools.
Yeah, some environmentalists in northern Arizona are basically pointing the finger at the Navajo Generating Station. Is that a fair thing to do?
Well, I understand why that would be. The Navajo Generating Station is one of the largest coal-fired power plants in the West. It sits very close to Lake Powell. But what we don't know, what we haven't measured yet, is trying to tease apart what is the proportion of mercury that might be coming from the Navajo Generating Station and perhaps entering Lake Powell and then getting into the food web versus that which could be coming from the global pool. And so we can't definitively answer that, but that is a follow-up study that we would very much like to do.
Dr. David Walters is an ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and the lead author on the study showing high levels of mercury and selenium in the Grand Canyon. David, thanks.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
People have known about mercury in the Colorado River system for around two decades, but environmentalists are still concerned about what the report found. Roger Clark is one of them. He's program director for the Grand Canyon Trust. And Roger, did the USGS study tell you anything you didn't actually already know?
Yes, it did. The main thing it told us, it confirmed what we already suspected, that mercury and other heavy metals are getting into the system below Glen Canyon Dam in Grand Canyon National Park. We just did not have data before that.
Some of the areas that were tested are fairly remote. I mean, do we have a sense of how these metals ended up in these remote areas?
Sure. We can speculate. There needs to be a lot more analysis of the exact source and the isotopes of, say, mercury. The most common source for mercury is from the air, and the most common source in this region is from coal-fired power plants.
How concerning overall is this situation and the results that you got from USGS?
Well, the cumulative impact of what we're now seeing in the Grand Canyon from toxins from outside of the Grand Canyon itself finding its way into the fish and the wildlife is becoming more and more alarming. We have evidence of uranium contamination in Grand Canyon waters, not so much in the Colorado River, but in the springs and seeps that supply the precious water sources for many very small communities of invertebrates, insects, etc. Those impacts, we don't really know what they are, but we know they're there, and there needs to be a lot more study. So we are concerned that the cumulative impacts of these various sources of toxins in the system will amount to certain population collapses and other unexpected declines in population, maybe leading to extinction. Those are very concerning.
Do you get the sense that there is still time to reverse what you're seeing right now, or has the ship kind of sailed on that?
Well, it all goes hand in hand with climate change. The cumulative effects of the emissions, for example, from coal-fired power plants in carbon dioxide create this freight train effect, wherein it'll take decades, if not centuries, to reverse. We don't know that that's the case with heavy metals, but it turns out that the same smokestacks that emit carbon dioxide also emit mercury.
If you didn't know what was going on, is this the kind of thing that visitors to the Grand Canyon or this particular area of the Grand Canyon would be able to notice?
Not really. Again, the cumulative impact of these emissions that you can't see, you can't smell, you can't take a picture of it going down the Animas River, for example, it's just invisible pollution that's so pernicious that accumulates in the systems over time, and oftentimes we find out about their effects after it's too late.
Roger Clark is a program director at the Grand Canyon Trust. Roger, thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Still to come, Phoenix is looking at ways at improving its hiking infrastructure. That story and much more is still ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Checking Valley traffic, 51 southbound. The exit ramp at Bell is restricted. On the 202 westbound, the accident that had been blocking the center lane at 32nd Street, now on the shoulder. Still lots of reports of signals not working in different parts of the valley. If you come upon one of them, treat it as a four-way stop and do be careful in that area. Valley forecast for today, calling for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 104. Partly cloudy skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s. Slight chance of storms both this afternoon and tonight as well. Right now with relative humidity 32%, it's 97 degrees at KJZZ at 219.
KJZZ is supported by St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance, observing Hunger Action Month in September. Encouraging citizens to forego one luxury this month to provide a necessity for the hungry. You can learn more at stmarysfoodbank.org.
It's the show on KJZZ. Along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Mark Brody. House Speaker and Ohio Representative John Boehner says people in his state are mad and deeply disappointed that their former governor and 25th president, William McKinley, no longer has naming rights to the tallest mountain in America. Now Republicans in Alaska support changing the name of the mountain to its native name, Denali. Here's Senator Lisa Murkowski.
For generations, Alaskans have known this majestic mountain as the Great One. Today, we're honored to be able to officially recognize the mountain as Denali. I'd like to thank the president for working with us to achieve this significant change to show honor, respect, and gratitude to the Athabascan people of Alaska.
And you can hear it in Senator Lisa Murkowski's statement there. The renaming or the return of Denali's name means a lot to Alaska Natives. But of course, McKinley wasn't alone. Mount St. Helens wasn't always called that. Neither was Mount Rushmore, for that matter. There's a lot of precedent here for renaming our monuments, both natural and contrived. And that's why Kenneth C. Davis is here. He's author of the Don't Know Much series, including Don't Know Much About the American Presidents and Don't Know Much About Geography. His new book is The Hidden History of America at War. Kenneth C. Davis, welcome back.
Good day. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And of course, we live in a place that was misnamed America by the first guy who drew the map. So there's a long history of naming places, and the first guy who puts it down on a map usually has a lot of say in these maps.
The naming rights, as we're fond of calling them now. Now, how did Denali lose its name to McKinley in the first place? Everybody kind of snickers about it now, thinking he was an inconsequential president, except for the fact that he was assassinated.
Not an inconsequential president at all, I would argue, first of all. If he hadn't been assassinated, he could very well have gone down as one of the great presidents, but of course assassinated at the beginning of his second term after having successfully won the war against Spain, which was a tremendous accomplishment, not without controversy. And then he was succeeded, of course, by Theodore Roosevelt, and because Roosevelt was such a larger-than-life character, really overshadowed McKinley for a long time, but we've kind of come to reassess McKinley. By the way, speaking of McKinley and geography, one of the things that happened during the war with Spain is that we went to war with Spain over the Philippines. It wasn't one of the places we set out. It was basically about Cuba. McKinley said early in the war that he couldn't find the Philippines on a map if he had to, like a lot of Americans at the turn of the 20th century.
And so it was Teddy Roosevelt after McKinley that named this mountain?
No, the mountain naming doesn't happen till later. It was kind of named informally in 1896 before McKinley even becomes president. There was a gold rush going on in Alaska, then a territory, not a state. And a prospector wrote back to a newspaper about this mountain and decided to name it McKinley in honor of McKinley, who had just gotten the nomination and was a big champion of the gold standard, which was a big issue in that time, political issue, the gold standard. The name before that had been various. Denali, of course, is ancient, an Athabascan name, meaning the tall one. The Russians had called it Bolshaya Gora. I'm probably mispronouncing that. Forgive me, Russians. An Englishman had named it Densmore's Mountain. So it had gone through. But this name in 1896 kind of stuck. And in 1917, more than 15 years after McKinley was assassinated, Congress decided to name the park and the mountain at the center of the park in McKinley's honor.
And then ever since then, almost, Alaska Natives and a lot of other people in Alaska have gone about the task of restoring that name as a sign of respect and really recognition, a small gesture, I suppose, but an important one.
It is an important one. I should also mention that it's the Secretary of the Interior who gets to do this, and I'm sure with the President's approval.
Oh, the Secretary. Okay, so that's all done at an Interior, we should remember. But Lisa Murkowski thanked the President, didn't she? One senator who was thankful to the White House. That's Kenneth C. Davis, author of the Don't Know Much series. His new book, The Hidden History of America at War, with a chapter, I'm told, on William McKinley himself. Kenneth C. Davis, thank you so much.
Thanks.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. As Arizona's largest city prepares to improve its bike path infrastructure by building more of them, improving others, and adding bike lanes across the city as part of the Prop 104 transportation proposal that passed last week, a new report shows a large increase in bicycle-related injuries. KJZZ's Phil Latzman spoke with a local doctor concerned about the risks of the increased load of bicyclists hitting the streets and hitting the pavement. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Mark. According to a just-released study in the September issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, the incidence of cyclist injuries went up by 28%, and hospital admissions more than doubled in the past 15 years. Dr. Natasha Buyan is a Valley area family physician. She says the recent passage of the multi-billion-dollar Phoenix Transportation Initiative means the issue should get even more attention in our region.
You know, there's numerous health benefits to biking. So stronger bones and muscles, decreased body fat, cardiovascular benefits, improved joint mobility. And then biking, it also helps mental health by decreasing stress and anxiety. But then the caveat to that is, when you're biking, there's certainly a risk of injury. But I think increasingly we're starting to see that we need to start educating the community as a whole. So we need to start educating drivers and pedestrians as well about bike safety.
You mentioned that there's been an increase in the amount of people actually getting on their bikes and riding, which sounds like a good thing if you are, you know, into exercise and health and keeping cars off the road. Mm-hmm. That is obviously, though, directly related to the amount of injuries that we're seeing.
The study also found that injuries in younger adults, so people between the ages of 18 and 44, actually went down by as much as 30%. And so that tells me that, you know, this is a group that is often better educated about bicycle safety, and they have lower injury rates. And so a lot of my patients, they ride their bikes as both a mode of transportation and also for the health benefits. And I actually don't see many injuries in my young adult patients because they tend to be more experienced riders and they exercise caution while riding. I think in Arizona, we are seeing that age group between 45 and 55. That tends to be where more of the injuries are. We know from other research that most accidents between drivers and bikers, they occur at intersections. And in Phoenix, 83% of all collisions occur where there are no bike lanes present. And so we're seeing with Proposition 104, we are investing in infrastructure improvements, which I think is a positive thing that definitely needs to happen. And I know the city of Phoenix has this ambitious plan to be a platinum level bicycle-friendly community, which I think is fantastic. And a big part of that plan also involves, you know, community education.
Dr. Bouyin, I saw recently on HBO a real sports segment about biking in big cities and why it's caught on in certain places and why it hasn't really caught on in the United States. Do you see this being one of the more bike-friendly places in the country eventually or in the world?
Yes, I would love to see Arizona as a bike-friendly state, especially when we have cooler weather. I think biking is something that is affordable. It's affordable for a lot of people. It's easy to do. You know, it's easy to store our bikes where we live. And so as long as we get investment from, you know, our city and our state and kind of buy-in from our residents, I think it's a great place for it to catch on.
That's Dr. Natasha Bouyin, a Scottsdale-based family physician. The Journal of the American Medical Association study was conducted over a 15-year period between 1998 and 2013, and as mentioned, the largest increase in bicycle accidents came among riders 45 and older. And ironically enough, Mark, as I was preparing this story, my wife was involved in a minor bike accident this morning involving a car at the intersection. So there are bike paths in my neighborhood, but she was riding on the street because they had all been flooded out.
Is she okay?
She's fine. Just a few bumps and bruises and a bike with a bent rim. A kind of a reminder for us of how difficult it is for bicycles and vehicles to share the road when there are no paths available and why cities like Phoenix are working to change that.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Phil, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
This summer has been a particularly brutal one, with a number of hikers dying in and around the valley. This has led to conversations about the services available at trails, like shade and water. Phoenix's Parks and Recreation Department is looking to improve the infrastructure at Phoenix Mountain Preserve and is hosting public meetings to get input from the public about what improvements they'd like to see. Joining me to talk about this is KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Mark.
So, of all the parks in Phoenix, why Phoenix Mountain Preserve?
Well, I asked this to Ken Vondershur, Deputy Parks and Recreation Director with Phoenix's Parks and Recreation Department, and he said that there are improvements currently being made at South Mountain, and then, of course, Echo Canyon had some work done to the parking area and the trailhead in 2013, and it just makes sense to go to Phoenix Mountain Preserve next. He also said that the portion at Piestewa Peak is over 50 years old and is in need of some improvement. Here's Vondershur.
There's nothing routine about the Phoenix Mountain Preserve. We get national park numbers in some of these areas, and more than national park numbers in some of these areas. We're super convenient. We love that. We want people to come to the mountains, but we want it to be efficient. We want the parking to be efficient. We want their visits to be enjoyable. We want them to be safe. And so we're taking all that into consideration.
So what kind of improvements are they considering?
Well, it's interesting. He actually said that they're not considering anything in particular just yet. They just really want to hear from the public. Here's Vondershur again.
We're letting them tell us at this point. So we don't have any preconceived notions of going into any of the mountain parks and doing specific projects. We know that we have some underground infrastructure that we need to improve. So the whole purpose of these meetings is really to gather public input, listen to what people have to say, listen to how they use the parks, when they use the parks, and what types of improvements they would like to see.
But to find out a little bit more about what exactly hiking infrastructure is and what's needed to maintain and improve trails like these, I spoke with Peter Olson, Vice President for Programs and Government Relations at American Hiking Society.
In the more rural backcountry hikes, infrastructure can be anything from rope or even chains on the trail. It can be signage on the trail. Anything that is not a natural feature on a trail that can assist the hiker or the visitor to find their way or stay safe or add an element of safety to their trip on the trail. In urban environments, it also includes things such as artwork and interactive features, educational aspects to it. It go all different directions.
What are some of the safety concerns in urban areas?
Well, I think one of the most relevant things for that is to have adequate information at the trailhead, because I think in urban areas, people think, oh, you know, I'm not going to get into trouble, and they're frequently inadequately prepared. And some near urban and urban hiking experiences can be far more sort of like a backcountry experience than they think. But also if they can inform them of things such as hydration requirements, and that could be, you know, people say bring 3 liters of water. Well, a lot of Americans, we don't measure in liters, we measure in quarts. What does that look like? You know, have 3 bottles of water there. of what we expect them to bring with them type of thing. So infrastructure starts at the trailhead. But in urban environments, they can probably include things such as potable water stations where people can refill water bottles, as well as shady areas, rest areas. But the other thing to include, if it's possible, and depends on the urban environment, are basically places where people can bail out. So if they're out for an 8-mile hike but can only go 4 miles, perhaps there's what we would call a side trail that would take them to a main road, would take them to a parking lot, would take them to a bus stop, something where people have the option. In extreme heat, it can cause disorientation and people start getting severely dehydrated. And by the time they realize something's happening, they can't walk 2 miles or 4 miles back out of the trail.
That's Peter Olson, Vice President for Programs and Government Relations at American Hiking Society.
KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
Just ahead, why a baby can affect its mother's health years after birth. That story and much more still ahead on the show. Hello, it's the show. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound, an accident at US 60. Also on the 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at 32nd Street. And lots of areas of traffic signals not working. Those should be treated as four-way stops if there's not an officer out directing traffic. Do be careful in those areas. Valley forecast calling for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 104. Partly cloudy skies tonight, chance of showers and storms, overnight lows in the mid-80s. It'll be partly sunny again tomorrow, still a slight chance of storms with a high of 103. It's 97 degrees at KJZZ at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by Dixie Green Promotions, presenting a fine arts and craft show with 40 exhibits Saturday and Sunday, September 5th and 6th, in the orchard at Charlie Clark Steakhouse on Highway 260 Pine Top.
It's a bit of a cliche, but Australia is often thought of as a pretty relaxed kind of place. Sun, surf, and a kind of happy-go-lucky attitude. But is it a myth? Now an Australian senator has set up a parliamentary inquiry into the extent to which the country has become a nanny state. Senator David Lionhelm says the country's adventurous spirit is being paralyzed by rules and regulations and that millions of dollars are being wasted on bureaucracy. Here's the BBC's John Donison.
Once a jolly swagman camped by a billabong under the shade of...
For me, the laid-back, easy-come, easy-go, throw-another-shrimp-on-the-barbie stereotype of Australia is encapsulated in the vibe of its unofficial anthem.
Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come...
But in reality these days, our jolly swagman would probably be pulled up for pitching his tent without a proper permit, lighting an illegal fire, or sparking up a ciggy in a public place. In a nation founded by convicts, the truth is, in modern Australia, they do love to lay down the law.
Australia is increasingly becoming a nanny state, and by that I mean the government is taking decisions out of the hands of adults and making decisions for them.
And now, Senator David Lionhelm, the sole parliamentarian from the Liberal Democratic Party, says it's gone too far.
We've got mandatory bicycle helmet laws, for example. We have a ban on e-cigarettes or vaping, as you call it in the UK. So there's no shortage of nanny state issues.
This month, even Vegemite, that Australian culinary icon, almost fell foul of the law.
Australia's iconic Vegemite is set to be taken off supermarket shelves because of fears it's being made into cheap grog.
So where did this nanny state culture come from?
This sort of moral obligation on politicians to do something when there's a problem. You know, if it was raining cats and dogs, you almost expect the media and public and so forth to say politicians should do something about it to fix any problem that arises rather than leave it to individuals or let it sort itself out or leave it to the market or whatever. Because I told you before, oh,
you can't do that. These days in Australia, it does seem there are all sorts of things where somebody will tell you, you can't do that, mate. And here on the busy streets of Sydney, I myself, an innocent abroad, have to hold my hand up and say that I've had a run-in with the law. Fined and threatened with court for crossing the road on a red light. So what does the senator make of that?
The only thing that I'd say about Australians is we still have a very healthy tendency to ignore laws. I wish everybody would refuse to pay their on-the-spot fines and go to court. It would jam up magistrates' courts something terrible, and they would go back to the police and say, stop being so stupid.
Well, maybe I'll quote the senator when I'm standing in the dock. Then again, maybe not. Because for now at least, in Australia, the law is the law.
That's the BBC's John Donison in Sydney. Parents have been known to be willing to do just about anything for their kids. A new research shows this intimate relationship between mother and child begins even before birth, although the effects aren't always positive. That's because some fetal cells make their way into the mom's bloodstream, something known as fetal microchimerism. Amy Boddy is a researcher in the psychology department at ASU. And Amy, what have you been studying?
We're looking at how fetal cells interact with the maternal body. So during pregnancy, fetal cells cross the placenta barrier and enter the maternal body. This is well known among doctors and scientists. But then after pregnancy, it had originally been thought that most of these cells and fetal DNA is cleared from the mother's body along with the baby. But research has been showing that there are cells that do stay in the maternal body after pregnancy, and they can be found decades later. And a big important question is, what are they doing there? And it seems like literature is painting a really paradoxical picture where it seems in some instances it's helping, benefiting the mother, and in other instances, it's actually causing harm.
So in what areas can having the fetal cells in the mother's body after delivery help, and in what ways does it hurt the mother?
So these type of cells that are probably the most interesting that cross the placenta are stem-like cells. So these are cells that have the ability to specialize into different cells in the maternal body. And so the ways that they can help the mother is there's been a lot of documented research where they've, in mouse models, have shown that the fetal cells actually migrate to a site of injury and seem to be helping heal the mother. And in human studies, they've been shown in C-section scars. So they've migrated to the C-section wound and are thought to have expressed certain proteins that make scientists believe that they are helping the mother.
And in what ways are they not so good?
So there's been a lot of research in women during labor and after labor in autoimmune diseases and cancer. And it seems like from tissue biopsies, there's sometimes more fetal cells in the diseased tissue than in the healthy tissue, leading us to believe that they may be either causing this autoimmune disease or cancer.
Do you have a sense of how far throughout the mother's body these fetal cells are traveling? Or do they tend to stay close to where they started, like near the womb, or are they all over the place?
Well, good question. They typically are traveling through the blood, right? And so the blood ends up in the lung first. So the highest concentration typically is in the lung, and then they travel through the other organs. There is now one study that came out in 2013 showing that there was expression of male DNA in a mother's brain, suggesting that it was from her son that she was pregnant with, so they can reach as far as the brain.
When you're looking at some of the potential harms, or I guess even some of the potential benefits, how do you single out the effects of these fetal cells versus any number of other things that we think could cause autoimmune diseases or Alzheimer's or help heal wounds?
That's a very good question, and it's been very difficult to study in this effect. Now that there's new techniques out there that are becoming more sensitive and specific, we can start to tease apart that, but that's been a major challenge in the field, and it's going to take a while to tease apart what is really going on.
You would think evolutionarily that some of the negative effects from childbirth maybe would have been done away with years ago. Otherwise, maybe we would stop having kids, right? If having them is more dangerous than childbirth already is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a major point that a lot of times when people hear about fetal cell microchimerism, they only hear about the conflict. But what we want to bring to light is that placenta mammals have been evolving with this fetal microchimerism for millions of years. So there's likely some cooperative benefit as well.
So what's the next phase of this kind of research that you're looking to do?
We're really interested in what fetal cells are doing in a normal pregnancy and postpartum, what they could likely be doing to help cooperate with the mother. If they're involved in lactational biology, would be very interesting. And also looking at just if fetal cells have any involvement in the hormonal system in the mother and if they play a role in maternal bonding. So those are our future directions.
Amy Boddy is a researcher in the psychology department at ASU. She studies, among many other things, maternal-fetal conflict. Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
Students interested in mining law have a new place to study it. Starting this semester, the James E. Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona established the Global Mining Law Center. It'll include courses on intellectual property, workplace safety, and water law, among others. This is part of a growing trend of specialized programs within law schools. To talk more about it, I'm joined by James Greif with the Association of American Law Schools.
Law schools across the country have been developing new centers and programs that draw upon the strengths of their regions. And this has become even more important over the last 5 years with the challenging job market, especially with respect to law firms. It makes a lot of sense for schools to study and provide opportunities for students, lawyers, non-lawyers, that tie into the growth of these local economies. And this is especially true for schools that have many graduates practicing law within the same state.
So does a program like that at least kind of imply that the school hopes that graduates will stay nearby to practice law afterwards?
Yeah, and I think it helps tie into those areas of growth within the region. So clearly, if in the case of Arizona, if there's a lot of growth within the mining industry, those particular graduates that practice law in the state are going to want a background in that particular area.
Is this in response to trying to get more students who might be interested in this particular area? Is it trying to fill a need in the marketplace for attorneys specializing in particular areas of law, something else?
Yeah, there are a number of centers that tie into areas of local economies. Vermont Law School has the Center for Agricultural and Food Systems. Washburn University in Kansas has an oil, gas, and law center. So I think there is a desire for specialized education in those particular areas where we do see some industry growth and some job growth. And law schools, there's 204 of them across the region. Many of those schools are regional in nature, meaning that a lot of the graduates are going to be practicing law in those particular regions. So tying into those areas, having that specialty, gives students advantage when they graduate.
Is there a danger in there being too much specialization in law schools and not enough sort of general law graduates?
Law school is a three-year degree program. And so generally when you think about the first year, it is foundations in the study of law. And so as you go into the second and third years, you go into more of the specializations. So clearly there's a need to have that background and foundation, but these centers and these new programs that are being developed are tying into these areas where there's clearly a need for that sort of specialization.
Do these kind of centers help law schools as far as fundraising or making inroads in industry or even like advertising, notoriety, that sort of thing, to get more attention for the school in general in the greater law community?
Yeah, and I think that it attracts students that have that particular area of practice or specialization in mind. So I think that law schools are looking at the needs of their region and trying to tie those particular centers and studies into there. So it's really benefits the region that has a need for the specialization and those students that want to practice that particular area of law.
James Greif is Director of Communications for the Association of American Law Schools. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. On the Valley Roadways, I-10 westbound, an accident at the 60 has the HOV lane blocked. On the 202 eastbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at Dobson has the right lanes blocked. And of course, be aware of areas where the signals are out. Treat those as four-way stops. Be careful in those areas as well. Partly sunny skies over Phoenix right now, 97 degrees at 251.
Expanded local coverage of arts and culture, early childhood, and healthy aging is made possible by support from Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust.
It's the show, along with the Takeaways' Todd Zwillick. I'm Mark Brody, and I've got a question for you. How did you spend your teenage summers? Maybe like a lot of kids, you worked at an amusement park.
Can you hand me a t-shirt, please?
Here, I have a resume. I don't know if you still want to take a look at it.
James, am I pronouncing that right? James?
James, yeah.
Okay, by accepting this t-shirt, you are...
hired.
Maybe you were a counselor at sleepaway camp?
Andy, are you going to clean that up?
Oh, yeah. I will. I don't have time right now.
Clean it up and come to my office for the meeting.
God, that sounds familiar. How about the all-important informal economy of the American kid, the banana stand?
Two sticks and extra chocolate. Is it Mardi Gras? What are you charging for that?
He doesn't like to discuss money.
I don't like
money.
To discuss money.
What does that mean? You don't pay for it?
A Bluth banana? No, I hadn't planned on it.
Now, summer jobs like the one made famous by Arrested Development's George Michael Bluth there, they're in decline by a lot. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the number of teens and young adults looking for employment declined steadily over the 90s and the 2000s. It's only now leveling off. In 1989, 8 in 10 American kids had official summer jobs, the paycheck kind. Today, it's only 6 in 10. That's a big drop. There are those who are quick to call the youth of today lazy compared to last generations, but for some young adults, it's just not that simple. And for those who can't find or won't find a summer job, they might be missing out on learning an important set of skills that come along with that very first gig. Joining us now, Sarah Bird Sharp. She's co-director of Measure of America, a research nonprofit studying well-being in the United States. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
And Sarah, youth unemployment you found is an important part of well-being. Are American kids missing out on something important here?
Absolutely. So we are, as you said, we're interested in well-being and measuring well-being, and we tend very much to talk about well-being looking at money metrics, and we're really focusing on people metrics, what you know people are doing. And one really fundamental measure of that is how kids are doing in their transition to adulthood. And so we're looking a lot at kids' employment and kids in school, and particularly at a population of kids who are doing neither. We call them disconnected youth.
Sarah, why are so many millions of kids not working now when they used to? Why has this number dropped off?
Well, I would would say the summer employment issue is really a lot to do with structural changes in our economy. So there are fewer low-wage jobs, you know, temporary low-wage jobs than there used to be, partly because some of those jobs have gotten automated and the economy is changing. I think school year is getting longer in some cases, and so there's less time to have a job. I think that, you know, definitely youth employment in the long term is declining.
Now, the recession, of course, is part of this. Everybody has fewer jobs. That's easy to understand. But these declines, like I said, they started way before the recession. American kids just aren't going for jobs the way they used to. Structural changes in the economy, but the attitude of kids themselves, are people now going for resume builders, internships? You know, I'm not going to get ahead flipping burgers for the summer. I need to go get a job at the accounting office. Has that changed?
I think that's a piece of it. I mean, I think there's a bunch of factors that are both because kids are making different decisions than they used to, and also because of the economy. I wouldn't say it's because kids aren't interested in working over the summer at all. I think that the interest pretty much remains the same.
So what are they missing out on specifically? What types of skills? Look, paycheck, obviously, learning to deal with your boss, sure. What do we know about what kids are really missing out on, whether they can't find work or just don't because they'd rather do something else? What's the consequence here?
Yeah, I would say the research that we've been focusing on is kind of the hardcore kids who try and who wish they could find jobs but are unable. And those kids really struggle. And, you know, one of the things they're missing out on is a sense of purpose, a place to go every day. And that, you know, as a starter, is really a difficult situation. And kids who don't have that experience, it can really sow the seeds of hopelessness for them that last for a long time. And it can also sort of arrest their possibility of starting to build a network, a professional network, having mentors who care about them and support them, having somebody every day who's giving them guidance. And so these kids who we've been looking at, these disconnected youth, are really at a serious disadvantage.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I mean, what do we know specifically from your research about how searching for a job at 16 and not finding it, for example, or 17 or 18, affects, you know, performance in school or getting into college or the quality of that first full-time job when you're 22 or 24? There has to be a knock-on effect, I assume.
What we found in our most recent calculations is that there are 5.5 million kids today in the United States who are in the 16 to 24 year age range who are neither working nor in school. That's like bigger than the population of 30 states. So that's too many kids. And the majority of those kids come from poor households. They tend to be low-income minority kids. And those are the kids that we're really targeting in our research to understand where they live, what are the challenges they're facing, and what are some of the solutions.
Okay, so what do we know then about the dollar spent on investment, whether it's a summer youth employment program? There's a big one in Washington where I'm from. People are comfortable with a big government program in the district like that. It's popular. But it may be a corporate internship program. It may be a nonprofit. All different ways to get kids out of idleness, if that's what they're doing, and onto a track.
I mean, I would say that the cost of these kind of programs is peanuts compared to the cost of not doing it. So we're paying already in terms of incarceration costs and Medicaid costs and public assistance. We might as well pay in terms of good programs and good schools. It actually costs less to prevent kids from, you know, dropping out of high school and being disconnected than it does to pay for the crisis, the full-blown crisis that happens when we don't.
Sarah Bird Sharp is co-director of Measure of America. Sarah Bird Sharp, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Todd Zwillick at our partner, The Takeaway.
Lassie. Oh, my Lassie, come home.
When little Joe wanted Lassie to come home, the collie had to do a lot of the work herself. Now we have technology to help us find missing pets. The show's Annika Klein tells us about one tool for Phoenix pet owners.
It's like a Google map, but instead of Thai restaurants, it shows you where cats and dogs were lost or found in the city. In 2012, Maricopa County Animal Care and Control launched their Stray Animal Mapping Tool. Melissa Gable is with Animal Care and Control and says the map worked well for animals that were turned into the shelter. The shelter employees would then update the map, including information on where the pet was found. But Gable says there was a limitation.
We're finding that there's just folks out there that just aren't comfortable bringing the animal to the shelter. So what we have done to enhance the tool is actually allow the public to put their own information in.
That new feature officially launched today. Now the map acts as a sort of digital bank of lost dog posters. Anyone who loses or finds a cat or dog can click on the map where it happened, fill in their information, and even upload a photo. Gable thinks it might help rescue groups too, many of which don't necessarily come into contact with the county's shelters in their rescue work. There are rescue groups of all types and sizes in the valley, and she says it can get overwhelming.
It's just really confusing as a pet owner if you've lost a pet. There's so many places to look.
Now, even if a pet has not been physically turned over to a county shelter, the map can still be a resource for locating Lassie or Fluffy or Maud. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
And I'm joined now in studio by Steve Goldstein, host of KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
So tomorrow, our listeners will hear a voice that you'll be talking to that a lot of them probably recognize.
Yeah, if you get up early or even not that early, as some people do, Marketplace Morning Reporter host David Brancaccia will be here with us. He's in town for a Phoenix Chamber of Commerce event. We're going to be talking about China, the volatility in the stock market.
Is that what we're calling it now?
We're always hearing that. It happened again today. And David has a lot of insights, having been a business reporter for a couple of decades.
Also, a pretty big story. You'll have some folks in to talk about what has become a very big story with the state government.
Right, whether it's Bob Stump's text, the so-called conflict of interest, perhaps, with Susan Bittersmith, a lot of controversy around the Corporation Commission. We'll have a couple of guests in to talk about whether things need to change, whether, in fact, commissioners should be appointed instead of elected. Maybe that would end some of the controversy.
And this is going to be more of a debate style.
Exactly,
format?
Kind of a pro-con. You know, should it change? Should it not? Should we be worried about it? Is it overhyped?
KJZZ's Here and Now. Steve Goldstein, the host. That's tomorrow morning at 11. Steve, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
The show was produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer and Sky Shout are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas, what's going on in your neighborhood. The show at KJZZ.org. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.